Welcome to Oncology Today, the role of PARP inhibitors in the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Thomas Herzog from the University of Cincinnati. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding program featuring Dr. Herzog's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to provide some perspective on how these valuable agents have been incorporated into clinical practice.
PARP inhibitors have probably been the biggest game changer in ovarian cancer in the last decade. And so what we saw was the first approval in 2014. So we're now 8 years into being able to use these agents clinically. And the first approval was actually with olaparib for beyond third line treatment. And what we found then was that there was a big interest in trying to look at these agents in the maintenance phase. And so the first look at that was actually in platinum sensitive maintenance patients. And so we had study 19, which was one of the original studies that was all comers for olaparib, but it was only a phase two. But then we had a number of phase threes that led to FDA approval for PARPs in platinum sensitive maintenance. So we had the NOVA trial, which was the first one to come out. And then we had Aerial 3 and Solo 2. And those trials looked at niraparib for NOVA. Aerial 3 was rucaparib. And Solo 2 was olaparib, but only in patients with a BRCA mutation. And so when we then got those approvals and then other PARPs, such as rucaparib, got approved for beyond third line and beyond. And then we had finally approval with Quadra with niraparib for treatment. You now had the ability to use these PARP inhibitors in later lines of therapy. But many of us thought that probably the biggest bang for the buck was going to be in frontline. And so at ESMO in 2018, Katie Moore presented the Solo 1, which was looking at using olaparib in patients with a BRCA mutation in frontline. We then had the following year in 2019 in Barcelona, we had three presentations at the presidential session of ESMO, which is pretty impressive. And two of those led to approvals. So one was the PRIMA study for niraparib for frontline across all biomarker subtypes. And then we had the olaparib plus BEV indication that was approved for all patients except those who did not demonstrate homologous recombinant deficiency. So HRD was positive. So that's where we were up until ASCO in 2022 for frontline, which added rucaparib into the mix. And that's a fairly complicated study, four-arm study with two objectives. One, to see if rucaparib indeed improve progression-free survival for patients in the frontline setting. And the second one was to look at nivolumab to see if the combination of nivolumab and the PARP actually added benefit. So the only data available for the presentation by Dr. Monk at ASCO was the mono, looking at rucaparib versus placebo. And indeed, there was a significant improvement in PFS. And so the data across all subgroups looked very promising with rucaparib in the Athena model. So that would give us a lot of options for upfront if that led to FDA approval. Thus far, it has not led to FDA approval. The agency has requested that there be more maturity, and we can talk more about that for the OS endpoint in that data set.
Just around the time that the data was being presented with rucaparib that you just referred to, was around the time we started to see Dear Doctor letters. And I think probably that was connected to, I mean, I thought it looked like the data from Athena really matched up well to what we'd already seen between olaparib and niraparib. And I was all excited that there was going to be another option. And then surprising to me, I was surprised the FDA didn't approve it. And it seemed like it was tied into some of these things that were going on about trials with later stage disease. Is that your take about why it was not approved?
Yeah, I think that was part of the, you're right. I think it got swept into a bigger movement than what we would normally have seen. I think had this data come out a year ago, it may have been a very different story. I know about a little over a year ago, the FDA started looking at the accelerated approval process very closely, as you know. And we had met with them regarding GYN oncology trials. And at that point, we had never had a dangling approval nor a retraction. So we were pretty happy with that, thinking that everything was fine. But they started looking at OS. And you know, this really goes back quite a ways, because we started talking to the FDA and quite a while ago in terms of what is an appropriate endpoint for frontline and even platinum sensitive ovarian cancer, because you have such long post progression survivals. And to preserve those, you need an incredibly large clinical trial number to be able to do that. And we had seen a dearth of new investigations, if you will. We went almost a decade with really only two approvals. One was conversion of pegylated liposomal doxorubicin to full approval from an accelerated approval. And an approval of gemcitabine along with carboplatin and platinum sensitive disease. And that's all we had had. And we were concerned that industry was telling us that they felt that the agency's stance was that OS was necessary. And we went to the agency and they said, well, that's actually not the case, but we need to talk about it. And so out of that came a workshop that was co-sponsored by SGO and AACR and ASCO, and I had the pleasure of co-chairing that. And so we had a tremendous dialogue with the FDA about the importance of surrogate endpoints such as progression-free survival in that setting, and they agreed that that was an appropriate endpoint with clinical benefit. And my concern and the concern of other thought leaders has really been that, is this now going to be a retraction of that position? And we were hoping to have an ODAC to talk about it, but that ODAC recently that had been scheduled and it was canceled. So I think that that's really been for us somewhat frustrating, because we feel that looking at these non-analytical endpoints that were underpowered and are not balanced, and looking at, you know, crossover that is as high as almost 90% in some of these trials, makes it really difficult to be able to say that there's a detriment in overall survival. And what is that detriment? You know, what degree are we looking at? And we haven't been able to get that answer. So I think, you know, further dialogue with the FDA would be helpful in terms of better understanding the opinions behind this.
Could you clarify a little bit about the issue that has come up related to the issue of survival in these later line trials and what your take is on it? And I guess the first thing before you get into that would be the issue of, are there any feasible reasons why you might see worse survival? And I guess the one that comes up would be, you know, development of second cancer, specifically AML and MDS. So do we know to what extent, if any, that factored into the fact that a number of these trials seem to show survival going the wrong direction?
Yeah, we think that that would be negligible based on the data we're seeing from the long-term data from PAOLA-1, for example, the long-term data from SOLO-1, and even the updated PFS data that we've seen from TOX from PRIMA. So we don't think that that's... It certainly could contribute, but not enough to really make a big difference. I think one theory that's out there that would be concerning, of course, is that the exposure to PARPs then can potentially make subsequent exposure to DNA damaging agents less responsive. So those cells become less responsive. Perhaps we're selecting out clones that are resistant. And that's one of the concerns. And that's certainly a theoretical concern that needs to be looked at. So I'm not dismissive of the fact that this is important and that, you know, first do no harm. I think that that's, it's really important that we understand that. However, when you look at the OS data, Aerial 4, I think, is a beautiful example of that, where this trial was largely done in a non-US population. And in platinum-sensitive disease, almost half the patients, 45% of the patients, did not receive subsequent therapy because of the customs and the regulatory environment in the country in which they were treated, largely Eastern European. And so that it's so non-typical for what would happen in the United States. And so if they had received, there's just so many things there. And then the crossover, as I said, was up to 89%. So how do you really, when there's such long, you know, there's years between the intervention and then the, you know, not so much for Ariel 4, but for example, the frontline and even in the platinum sensitive maintenance trials, there's years between those and many, many months in most all cases, even in the later line treatment trials, that they're getting treated with other active agents, they're getting treated with other things. So it needs to be looked at. But a lot of this data will be very difficult to recover. There's some, you know, there's dropout, there's all kinds of issues with getting granular data for some of the questions that we want to answer.
In terms of this apparent adverse effect on survival, does it apply to all three drugs?
Well, I think that what we've seen is there's been less of an effect with olaparib than there has been with the others. But I honestly think that that is more from just the way those trials were conducted, more than there is a difference between the PARPs in terms of efficacy. So I personally don't think, I think it's more of a class effect than anything else. But if you go through each of the HCP letters, I think that, remember that, for example, with Solo 2, that was only done in germline. So we don't have as much data on those HRP type patients, for example, in that setting. You'd have to really generalize from the phase 2, which was study 19, which, you know, obviously a much smaller data set.
And these later line trials, were they generally monotherapy, or were they monotherapy, or were they the use of, you know, patients who were responding to platinum, platinum sensitive, followed by maintenance?
Well, it was a mixture. We can certainly go through those. But for example, Solo 3 was monotherapy up against physician's choice chemo. And in that particular case, it's a little odd because these patients were platinum sensitive in Solo 3, yet they were not using a platinum. You could use any of the non-platinum agents in that setting, such as pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, gemcitabine, paclitaxel. So I think it's a little bit unnatural with that particular trial. However, if you look at Ariel 4, which I just talked about, that would be also monotherapy, but it's up against, in the case of those that were more than 12 months out, they received platinum plus one of those agents. So that was the control arm, was platinum-based chemo versus monotherapy PARP.
Is there any reason that a physician should be concerned about using any of these three PARP inhibitors in the platinum sensitive situation as maintenance?
Well, the FDA just said there is, you know, we've seen with Nova now that that was the first to fall, 3 weeks ago or so, they retracted that label for patients that were not germline BRCA mutated, which we were very surprised that it didn't get extended to at least the HRD for use. So again, we have serious concerns about that. I think, time will tell, and there's a lot of efforts right now in terms of trying to get the right data before the FDA, that hopefully, can be reconsidered. Do I personally have concerns? I don't. For the HRD population, especially, I don't have concerns. The HRP population probably is a little, less clear in terms of benefit.
I guess one of the issues, you know, I'm trying to read the way the GYN investigators, including you, are kind of, you know, reacting to all this. And from my kind of macro perspective, I guess to me, one of the things that really colors the conversation, for example, about rucaparib not being approved in the primary maintenance settings, is you have alternatives. And I think, you know, you have alternatives also in the platinum sensitive situation. So my sense is that the investigators kind of understand why the FDA is thinking the way they are. Maybe they don't completely agree with it, but they maybe understand it, but are not that upset because there's still the opportunity to use other PARP inhibitors in the primary situations where you see a lot of benefit, which is, of course, primary maintenance, but also, I think, platinum-sensitive relapse.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I think that the biggest thing to me in terms of the take-home is that these most investigators now see the value of using the PARPs earlier, especially if there is a molecular signal, certainly a BRCA mutation, and likely an HRD molecular marker that's positive. In those cases, I think most people feel that the benefit is so great in terms of, you know, you do hazard ratios of, say, 0.43, 0.5, you'll see in this individual studies in the HRD group that you're purchasing a tremendous number of progression-free months because it's frontline, it's upfront. So the purchase, the value to the patient is so great. So I think there's a lot, you know, the idea of using it for treatment would, where someone was PARP naive, would be in a very special circumstance where they were likely treated by someone that was a very low volume treater and wasn't aware of testing and so forth. So we don't see those patients very often anymore. And my hope is we hardly ever see them as we move forward. So hopefully it'll even take some of the pressure off of platinum sensitive maintenance, whereas most of these patients will have seen a PARP up front. Brings into the question, though, of PARP after PARP and the benefits there. And we have some data, but not a lot of data that tells us it's probably okay to use it. But the benefit may not be as great as we had hoped.
You brought up this issue of PARP after PARP. And of course, we've seen some data on that. I guess the Oreo study is the one that I'm familiar with. Can you talk about what they looked at there, what they saw, and kind of what you think it means?
Yeah, the Oreo trial was a trial that was patients that had previously received a PARP, and then they're now getting, so this is now down the road, they're still platinum sensitive, so they receive a platinum-based therapy, and they then have to respond to this platinum-based therapy. Some of these patients were heavily pretreated, meaning they had a fairly responsive phenotype in terms of continued response. They broke the trial into two cohorts, one being BRCA mutated and then non-BRCA mutated. And then they randomized 2-1 to olaparib versus placebo. So you had about 70-some patients in the treatment arms in each of those two cohorts and roughly 35 or so patients in the placebo arm, if you will. They saw some fairly impressive hazard ratios in the 0.45 to 0.55 range with those cohorts. The problem was, getting back to what we were talking about in terms of time that was purchased, it was fairly little. In fact, we saw, I think, only an improvement of 1.5 months, although it was statistically significant. But clinically, you know, how valuable is that? So I think my take on that trial is really this. If you are a believer in PARP after PARP and you want to have the patient disprove to you that she's not going to respond, you have evidence now that you can do that. And there appears to be a clinical benefit that's statistically significant. If you're not a believer in PARP after PARP, you can cite the relatively small improvement in the median and say, well, I don't know if it's worth it. And therefore you'd have some evidence to stand on and not retreating them. Personally, as an academician, I'm not very impressed with the median gain. As a treater, though, when someone's before me and they have a mutation and they had a long PARP exposure before, which there's some things you can tease out if they didn't have visceral metastasis and if they had longer exposure to PARP on that front line that they got it or the previous time that they received it. And this would have been patients that were platinum sensitive when this trial was being conducted, maintenance. You then would have, I think, an opportunity to re-expose the patient to a PARP. So if someone's sitting before me as a patient, I really would want to see if she had a BRCA mutation and she had that long exposure. I would offer her PARP after PARP.
So let's get into some of the practical issues that come up in these scenarios.
Great. So this was a lady that came in, had CT scan showing large volume ascites. Her symptoms were very clear that she had large volume disease that was present and fairly widespread. Imaging supported that. So she had paracentesis that had been performed. And what we did was found that she had high-grade serous and made the decision to treat her with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So, you know, when patients come into you with ovarian cancer, there's certain decisions that you need to make pretty quickly. One, are you going to use bevacizumab, yes or no, with chemotherapy? And the first decision is really surgical. When are you going to go in and do a surgical cytoreductive procedure on this patient? And in this case, we felt that the chances for all tumor clearance would be fairly low with the disease in the mesentery on the surface of a lot of the bowel and so forth. So we felt that doing neoadjuvant chemotherapy was the way to go. So she received three cycles. CA-125 fell with that significantly. We went in, did surgery, midline incision, and TH, BSO, omentectomy, and so forth. And I believe that this was a case we used the argon laser, which we typically do on that. And peritoneal stripping is very common with this and so forth. And so we were able to get her down to a good place in terms of all the gross disease, I believe, was ablated or removed. She was known to have hypertension. It was well controlled. Performance status was zero. You can see her very high CA-125 of over 2100. And she had genetic testing that was done. It was BRCA wild type.
If I could just follow up with a couple of questions. First of all, you noticed that she's BRCA wild type. What specific assays do you typically do? Do you use just germline panel? Do you use NGS to look for somatic also? Do you use both?
Yeah, we're a little complicated. It all depends on the patient, insurance, and so forth. We always get germline at some level, especially if the tumor comes back BRCA, then we have to go to germline because that sets up cascade testing and also testing and screening for the patient herself in terms of other cancers and so forth. So we always get that information at a minimum.
And another question relevant to this is the question of neoadjuvant therapy versus not. This lady seemed like she had, you know, kind of obvious large volume disease. But in, you know, less clear-cut cases, how do you make that decision? Do you use laparoscopy, for example?
I do. The other advantage of using laparoscopy, Neil, is that what we find sometimes doesn't happen that often, but maybe 10-15% of the time, you can actually do neoadjuvant chemotherapy after maybe you've just gotten cytology or a small core from the omentum. You didn't send it for any analysis in terms of tumor. And by the time you do your neoadjuvant, say the patient scheduling wise or whatever, it's not infrequent that these patients will receive four cycles of chemo, for example, before you go in. And we'll find that all the tumor is necrotic and the pathology is unable then to process for any molecular changes, which is good for the patient in the sense that she's had a tremendous response, but not so good in terms of accurate treatment planning. And so for those reasons, if it's borderline, I will often do laparoscopy, not only to determine if I think I can resect everything, but also I can get a big chunk of tissue at that time, even if I'm going to go ahead and do neoadjuvant. And now I'll have all that information very quickly.
Interesting. Another question I have is, in what situations, if any, do you use Bev with chemo as part of neoadjuvant treatment?
Yeah, great question. So I think you'll find that there's centers, and even within centers, there's disagreement. There's some physicians and some centers who tend to use Bev in almost everyone. And there's some centers and physicians who use Bev very rarely. I'm in probably the bigger group, which tends to use it in those patients that we consider high risk, basically from the analysis that was done on OS after ICON 7, which was a frontline Bev trial, looking at patients that seemed to have an OS benefit, you know, those with large tumor volumes, stage 4 disease, ascites, pleural effusions. And we know how well bevacizumab does in terms of drying up those effusions. And so that, to me, is the biggest challenge for these patients. You have someone like this who's now becoming nutritionally challenged because of the large volume ascites. And then she didn't have a big problem with it, but many of our patients do that are in this setting. They also have pleural effusions that are clinically an issue. So they're having trouble sleeping, laying flat. They're having trouble breathing and doing any activities that have exertion. So I think because of that, I always use Bev in those settings. Nationwide, the number is somewhere between 40 and 50%. If you look at stage 3, stage 4 ovarian cancer, a little less than half the patients receive Bev based on the data I've most recently seen. So then she did well and normalized her CA-125. I believe it was down, I don't think we got it less than 10, but it's somewhere under 15, I think it was 11 or 12. And so would you give maintenance therapy to this patient? And by indication, you know, yes, olaparib wouldn't be indicated because she's BRCA wild type. And we don't have information on her HRD in this particular case. Niraparib, you could certainly do. Rucaparib, not approved at this point. Bev, you could continue the Bev. Could you give Bev plus PARP? Well, you know, you have some data with niraparib and Bev that's phase 2 landmark analysis that, you know, we're seeing in print. It'll be interesting to see if that changes compendium guidelines, but right now that would not be it's technically indicated, although probably be able to be done. And then other people would say, no, I would just watch and follow this patient closely. And so those are all the real options there are really Bev, niraparib, or observation. And so I think that that's sort of the discussion with the patient that you have at this point. Now we went ahead and tested and got the HRD. So she had the optimal cytoreduction. You can see she does have hypertension, but it was well controlled. She got 7 cycles. And the other thing is, how often do you give the Bev with chemo? And I know some people with neoadjuvant omit the Bev completely for the first few cycles. I'm not a believer in that. I actually believe that's the time that you most need it, because you really want to quickly get that large volume ascites, and if there's a pleural effusion, under control as quickly as possible, because it allows the patient to stay on chemo on the schedule. There's no delays. They don't get admitted to the unit for something else. And so I think it's important to try to keep that going as much as possible. You do certainly want to be mindful of the fact that you don't want to use bevacizumab within 28 days of surgery. On either end for wound healing, and you don't know if you're going to be doing a bowel resection and so forth. So do omit it very often before that as well. And then in this case, she was an R0, and then she had the myriad test showing that she was HRD positive. And I don't believe we had a score there, but it would have been above 42. So in this case, we just added the olaparib to the Bev, which would certainly be reasonable and obviously the easiest thing to do. Continues on treatment. I saw her a few weeks ago and was still doing well, tolerating the olaparib well. I believe her Bev's off now. She's just on olaparib.
How long has she been on olaparib, and how long are you planning to treat her for?
I think she's on, she's about month 18 or 19, somewhere in there. So we'll take her to 2 years and then have that discussion of stopping, which I encourage them to do based on the trials. I have some patients who can't wait to come off because they may have had a short break and they say, boy, I really feel a lot better when I'm not on this. And then I've had other patients that are, you know, they're in support groups, they read the literature, and no disease at 24 months and all the large volume disease that she had. She knows she's in a spot that is very different than what would have looked like 3 to 5 years ago when we wouldn't been able to offer her a PARP.
Does that mean patients like that like to continue?
They do. They're very, I wouldn't even say superstitious, but they're very concerned that removing the PARP could allow the disease to come back.
Yeah, you hear the same thing about, you know, long-term endocrine therapy and breast cancer. The patients start to, you know, feel very, very comfortable with it. So this lady had no GI issues, no cytopenia, just cruised right through it.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, but, you know, we're fairly used to dealing with that. She didn't have any major issues. I think she started off, we start everyone on a regimen for GI in terms of nausea and vomiting to try to prevent that in the first place, and we have them continue it. And if they're not having any side effects, I have them continue with that. We usually use a 5-HT3. Drug and we go forward with that. Eating, the olaparib's obviously twice a day versus niraparib once a day. Eating it with fatty foods appears to be a benefit as well in terms of nausea and vomiting. With niraparib, not obviously in this case, we found that, there's different ways you can do it in terms of I try to have them start with eating it with food. Surprisingly, I've had patients that have done better with it in the morning, and yet other patients have done much better with it in the evening. I had some patients where we tried something totally different and had them take it right before they go to bed. They kind of sleep through that a little bit. And so I think you just have to play a little bit with the timing and occasionally the dose, but I always start with the timing first to see if we can overcome those issues.
Just to get back to the issue of duration of treatment, do you follow sort of the trial approaches? You know, niraparib was used for 3 years, olaparib for 2 years. I'm not sure exactly why that was done. A lot of people in practice just do that. Do you do that, or you individualize it more?
Yeah, I think since the concerns came out, although, you know, we're pretty happy with the frontline numbers with myelodysplastic syndrome and AML, I tend to follow the trial more for protecting myself, I guess, to some degree. If we're varying from that, I make a note in the chart that a discussion was had about the concerns of continuing and so forth. The difference between the two is interesting. Does that make sense to continue? I know talking at some of the folks at Memorial, even with niraparib, I believe, I don't want to speak for them, but a couple people have told me they're shutting it down at 2 years, even though the trial went to 3 years with their patients. At least having that conversation at that point and documenting if the patient wants to continue, then that's all documented.
I'm curious, in this patient who got neoadjuvant chemo / Bev, what you would have done if her HRD was not positive. She was, you know, HRP.
Yeah, I would have done I would have continued the Bev, likely, as far as a recommendation. But I would have, I think that there's a lot of equipoise there in terms of, you know, for example, Neil, if someone has a BRCA mutation, I'm probably going to be an advocate for PARP versus just presenting the data and doing the shared decision model, if you will. In the case of the person who we think is homologous recombination proficient, I think there's some benefit to Bev. We're already on Bev if she's tolerating it well. This lady had hypertension, but we really didn't have any problems with it. It's certainly not like what we see with some other drugs, lenvatinib, for example, where we have quite a bit of things that we really need to be much more aggressive with the hypertension control. And if she's tolerating it well, I think Bev would have probably been, but it would have been a soft recommendation versus, if she said, look, I'm really tired of all this and that, I would have probably said, well, why don't we try a few more cycles of Bev? If you're not happy, we'll stop there. And that would have been it. And that would probably have been the most likely outcome there.
For a patient who is, more oriented around minimizing her chance of recurrence, and maybe, as you say, some patients who really try to get into literature, I mean, I'm sure you've had patients or physicians, even oncologists, would you be open to using a niraparib plus Bev?
Yeah, I mean, I think, from the Ovario data, you have data that at least from as best you can tell from that type of trial, it looks to reflect the activity that we would see with olaparib plus Bev largely. And there's no reason to think niraparib would be inferior. So I wouldn't have a problem considering that. And in fact, have done that on occasion, but it's pretty rare.
One other thing, getting back to the Athena trial that I personally thought was really interesting and reassuring. Until the Athena trial, we only had one study looking at HR proficient, the PRIMA study with niraparib that showed a benefit. And it was reassuring. I think it looked like exactly the same thing with rucaparib. Was that your take?
Yeah. In fact, the hazard ratios, you can't compare across trials. There's differences between those trials, obviously, but they looked at least as good. In fact, numerically better. So it really is good news. The other trial that some people look at is a similar trial to PRIMA that was done in China, the PRIME trial that came out. And that reinforces the same thing you're saying, that those HRP patients do have some benefit. Now, it's an imperfect test. So many people say, well, it's just picking up patients that are HRD, that, those were false negative tests, if you will. So
I don't know if you know, but there's a recent data in prostate cancer with PARP. And interestingly, you see benefit with olaparib in HR proficient and not with niraparib in prostate, which kind of makes you wonder whether or not this is really just a PARP issue. It doesn't really matter which PARP inhibitor but then the other question is why? Why do you see benefit in HR proficient patients? What do you think is going on?
Yeah, well, I think for ovary, my understanding with prostate, and I'm totally out of my lane here, so push me back in quickly, but the HRP, population. I think one of the things with prostate is it seems like it's a little more dependent on some of the related genes, the ATM, BRIP, RAD51C, RAD51D, and so forth. Whereas those are somewhat important in ovary, but it seems like that genomic instability is more important in ovary than it is in prostate. And so I do think it's you can look at the cutoffs, I think. For example, in the Velia trial that looked at veliparib, they used a lower cutoff of 33 versus 42. If you look at the receiver operating curve, if you just eyeball it, it looks like a good place to cut it would have been around 38. So are you actually getting patients that had a score of 38, 39, 40, 41? They're getting classified as HRP, I would fully expect that those patients are going to respond. And that to me is probably the largest contributor to that group. And I'm sure there's other mechanisms that we don't understand as well that are contributing also.
Really interesting. Let's go into your next case.
Okay, so this is a 52-year-old who presented with a large pelvic mass. It's complex, meaning that it's not a simple cyst. There's solid elements to this tumor. She had some very small volume ascites. It was not clinically apparent, no fluid wave, nothing like that. She had high-grade serous histology. CA-125 was elevated. She had a performance status of zero. You can see the genetic testing that was done there, showing that she had tumor BRCA positive, of course, HRD positive as well. She had underwent primary cytoreduction. So this is a lady who we were pretty confident, based on imaging, that there was not a lot of carcinomatosis or anything like that. Indeed, that's what we found. So she had some omental involvement, but not even the classic omental cake where the entire omentum is infiltrated with tumor. It was more focal, but she did have, it was greater than 2 centimeter implants in the omentum. So she was a stage 3C. The omentum, interestingly, though, on her left side is where most of this was, and it was densely adherent to the spleen. So we ended up having to do a splenectomy on her as we traced that up. So her incision kept getting longer and longer towards her xiphoid as we did the procedure. We were thinking we wouldn't have to go that high, but we did to fully get that omentum in the disease that was related to that out. She underwent carbopaclitaxel times 6. CA-125 was 7.1 after 6 cycles, which is important because we know normalizing that portends a better prognosis. So there's a picture of her high-grade serous cancer there, and then the question of what would you do in terms of maintenance. So here's sort of what we did. So she had a nice response to her primary surgery, followed by adjuvant carbopaclitaxel. And she was found, so we reflexed to a germline test, and she was found to have a BRCA2 mutation. So we started her on olaparib, and we waited 4 weeks. Some people wait less, some people wait longer. I find that I try to wait at least 4 weeks, or you can sort of conflate the side effects from recovering from chemo with PARP. And I find that if you get the patient off to a bad start, she was not frail. She was young, healthy, very vigorous exerciser and so forth. So I felt comfortable starting her at 4 weeks. She got through 2 years of treatment really without very much in terms of problems. Her biggest issue was that of fatigue. We took a couple weeks off here and there, but no more than a week or 10 days at any one point.
How do you decide between olaparib and niraparib in patients with BRCA germline mutations?
I'll admit, for me, there's a bit of a halo effect from SOLO-1 because you have a large phase 3 trial that looked at these patients, and it was done first. So now we have this wonderful long-term data that's come out. Katie Moore originally presented it, and Susanna Banjeri, so we have all these data sets that have continued to evolve. And now with OS data at 7 years and so forth, that was just presented at ESMO in Paris. So, I think it's really reassuring. Do I think that niraparib would do worse? I do not. I think that I'd be comfortable with either one. And so if she started having a lot of problems with GI or something else, I would have probably switched her over to niraparib, which, by the way, is also FDA indicated there.
If you had the option, would you also be open to using rucaparib?
If I had the option, I would. I don't believe that I have any concerns in terms of a diminution in efficacy.
Let's go to your third case, your last case, the 64-year-old lady.
She presented, the 64-year-old woman presented with a large pelvic mass. She had a mental cake with carcinomatosis. So again, pretty familiar picture as you're starting to see here, with advanced stage ovarian cancer. And unfortunately, most of our patients are advanced stage. So probably almost 75-80% of the patients I see are stage 3 or 4 at the time of diagnosis. So CA-125 elevated, performance status was good. She underwent a primary cytoreduction, had fair amount of disease. It was probably one of those patients that was questionable. But what led us to do this is she was highly symptomatic from her mass. So she was having trouble eating. She was having bladder spasms with the mass pushing on her bladder. She was having trouble with bowel movements. We had her on a full liquid diet, in fact, the week or 10 days before surgery, because she was having real trouble evacuating stool. I think the mass was just pushing at the pelvic brim on the colon and obstructing there, pseudo obstruction. So I think that that was what pushed us to do this. And we were in there and we thought we could get this down to at least optimal, which we did. But she had some small volume disease. It was scattered on the surface of the bowel, sort of diffusely on some of the areas of the peritoneum. We got all the major areas cleaned up. We did as much as we could on the bowel surface, but there was too many areas. There was not a focal area where we could have resected and gotten her to R0. So that's how she ended up where she was. She then underwent chemotherapy, had a complete response based on imaging as well as her. I believe she normalized her CA125. I think I have that on there. And then her genetic testing turns out she's HRD negative and does not have a BRCA mutation, obviously, with that as well. So then the question is, you know, would you give her maintenance therapy at this point? And so options here would be, she was not on Bev, so that would be a bit of an odd thing to start Bev. We tend to use it with chemo and then in maintenance. Has anyone ever done that? I haven't done it. I can't think of doing it recently at all. I know others who have done it as an option, just started it, even though that is not how GOG-218 or ICON 7 were conducted. So really, the choices in my mind here are to use niraparib or to do close surveillance. We started this woman on niraparib, if I remember. Yep. I took you through all, I think, the first part there. Let's see if there's anything that, no, I think we covered all that, stage 3C. She did not have high-grade serous. She had an endometrioid. Which, by the way, was a histology that was allowed on these maintenance trials as well. So we feel pretty good about that histology being responsive to a PARP inhibitor. And we talked to her about what she wanted to do. She was someone who was very, she had joined the support group in our area and had talked to a lot of patients that had been on maintenance and sort of was of the mindset that maintenance is part of what I should get with frontline treatment. Most of the people she had developed a relationship with who had had ovarian cancer that were recently treated had all had maintenance of some type. So she wanted maintenance and we settled on the niraparib. We talked about, you know, the advantages that we saw as well as some of the toxicities that we would be concerned about. She did not weigh very much. She was probably 125, 130 pounds. So she fell under that 77 kilogram. So by weights and plates criteria, she was started at the lower dose. So not instead of 300 milligrams QD, she was started at 200 milligrams and really did pretty well. She had some, a little bit of platelet issues the first month. And we held, not for very long, 3 or 4 days, rechecked, and they had returned to normal. She never had any bleeding issues or anything like that. So we did not, I was concerned in going down any further, which would be a third of the original label dose. So we were able to keep her at 200. And like many of these patients on PARPs, most of their symptoms seem to get better. So if you can get them through the first 2 months or so, things kind of go to autopilot. They start figuring things out. the help of our pharmacists and our team, we're usually able to make any adjustments in terms of nausea meds or anything like that. Occasionally, you have to start something like olanzapine or something like that in terms of controlling the nausea, but it's not that common. We can usually do it with the 5-HT3 drugs. And so she did well, and I think you know, she's pretty typical of what we see with patients that present with these large masses.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Herzog, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.